What's going on, guys? I'm Zach, your host of the Augzoro podcast, and welcome to the inaugural, which is, I think that means the same thing as first, so that was redundant, but welcome to the first edition of Augzoro Chats. So basically, when I was going over what I wanted to happen this New Year's in terms of goals for Augzoro, things that I wanted to do, I figured it would be a good idea, in addition to having the guest episodes, to put an episode, one episode per week. I think the format that I'm going to follow is an Augzoro chat on Monday and then a guest episode on Wednesday, at least for the start of this year. But I wanted to have a sort of chat where I kind of just riff on some things that, you know, are happening in the media, things that I'm reading, what I'm listening to on other podcasts, experience that I have in person without a guest. It's just going to be kind of me talking about some things that I want to expand on or get off my chest. I think Theo Vaughn is a big inspiration and a big reason why I wanted to start the Augzoro chats, because I know Theo Vaughn follows kind of a similar format. He hosts a podcast called This Past Weekend that I highly recommend you guys check out. But he has a guest episode every week, and he also has an episode where he just comes in and talks about some shit, and it strikes me as very honest and open. And yeah, I wanted to have a format like that, because I think hopefully people that are listening to this, if you're listening to this right now, that you get something out of it. And then for me, it kind of helps me figure out some shit along the way. So welcome to Augzoro Chat, hashtag 001. The first thing that I wanted to talk about is the concept of action curing anxiety. There have been so many times in my life where I feel anxious. Everyone gets anxious. You think that the world is gonna collapse on you, and the longer that you go without taking any action to kind of combat the things that are building up in your life. So, for example, you know, if you're dating someone and you don't really see a future with them, or you've been meaning to break up with them, and you kind of keep avoiding the conversations that you want to have, or these little things build up in your mind that you want to bring up when you go out on a date, or you're just chilling in your apartment, you never really verbalize to what you want to say to that person, that anxiety starts to build up. So it's been my experience, and I think it's been the experience of many other people, that just taking action, no matter how small, can be a part of not, I don't want to say curing that anxiety, because I think if you're someone that struggles with anxiety, there will always be some sort of baseline level that is there. I don't think it's ever going to completely go away, but there will be small things that you can do to lower that anxiety and go through life more comfortably. Which is what everyone wants. When you wake up, you just want to fucking feel good and have a good day, and then string a bunch of good days together. I read this book last year called The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. And it's written by Mark Manson. And one of the core ideas of the book is the inspiration, motivation, and action cycle. So to kind of tie this into the anxiety portion, this is how most people go through life. This is sometimes how I still do it. You crave some sort of emotional inspiration first. So you go and read a bunch of motivational quotes. You're waiting for that lightning bolt strike to just hit you in the brain and kind of just fucking jolt you into action. You're waiting for something to happen to you first before you take action. So the emotional inspiration needs to come first. Then is the motivation. The motivation feeds off of that emotional inspiration. So because you read that quote, because you were scrolling through Instagram and you watched that motivational video, because you listened to a motivational podcast, you now feel motivated and you need something to do with that motivation. And so then if the motivation is strong enough, then you take action. And this is, I think, how a lot of people go through life. This is how I have gone through life. And I think it can be unhealthy and unproductive because the action that you take relies on a feeling. It's a fleeting, it's something that's fleeting, and you're waiting for something to happen to you. And Mark Manson, the author of The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, kind of opened up the way that I look at anxiety, the way that I look at action. So he kind of flips that cycle on its head and goes, this is how it should be first. It should be action first, then inspiration, and then motivation. So it's kind of instead of waiting for something to happen to you, then it just becomes a cycle that feeds off of each other. So you take the action first. Let's take writing, for example. Going into this year, I'm trying to write more consistently. And so I know to do that, I have to set my environment and set a time. So I haven't decided what time I want to do it consistently every day yet, but let's just say it's 11 a.m. every day. I'm going to sit down and write for 1 hour. Regardless of what it's about, I'm going to choose one topic, one thing to write about for 11 o'clock, and I'm going to sit down and do it. So the action comes first. And that action does not depend on how I'm feeling or how inspired I am. So if I wake up feeling like shit, or if I wake up feeling okay, or if I wake up feeling great, I'm still going to sit down at 11 a.m. and write. And I've been taking this approach with writing and with other things in the past, and it is actually crazy how that action can lead to inspiration. So you can sit down and start to do something and feel like shit. Maybe you just don't feel inspired. And then through the act of writing, through the act of podcasting, through the act of painting, whatever activity it is that you're doing, you start to find an inspiration. That action kind of coaxes the inspiration out of you, and you feel rejuvenated kind of doing it because you feel good about yourself. Even if, you know, you're having a bad day, you're still sitting down and getting the work done. You're not waiting to feel inspired first and then doing it. And then in turn, that inspiration motivates you. So it goes action, inspiration, and then motivation. So because you have felt that inspiration, you then are motivated to want to keep doing it and doing it again the next time. And basically putting yourself in situations where that is going to happen again. And, you know, honestly, that's kind of like what's happening right now for me with this podcast, the Auxoro chats. I've never done an Auxoro chat before, and I wasn't feeling particularly inspired to do it today. I knew it was something that I planned out, and I planned out some topics that I'm going to address within the next 30 minutes or so. But when I started talking 5 minutes ago, you know, I was nervous. I was thinking, you know, are people going to think what I'm saying is fucking stupid right now? Is anyone going to listen to this? Am I even going to make sense? And then, you know, 2-3 minutes into this, it starts to feel pretty good. It feels like things are flowing more smoothly. So, yeah, man. The action, inspiration, motivation cycle, I highly recommend checking out the book, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. I think in addition to the cycle, it has a lot of other good things that you can use to go through life to not give a fuck. And honestly, like, that's what we're all trying to do. I feel so much happier not giving a fuck about the things that don't matter. And it's not to say that you don't give a fuck about anything. It's that you have a small number of people and a small number of things in your life that you truly care about, and limiting that output to maximize your input of fucks that you're giving, which is what this book is about. He kind of walks you through his mentality and not giving a shit what other people think of you, and being secure in your own thoughts and ideas and your whatever you're producing. And reading the book isn't enough. You have to put these types of things into practice and remind yourself of these things. But, you know, one of the things that I remind myself of is this action, inspiration, motivation cycle. And that allows me to kind of tap in to that extra cylinder where, you know, if I don't feel like doing something that day, maybe I don't feel like going to the gym. It could be something as simple as not wanting to run for 20 minutes or, you know, lift weights for 30 minutes. I know that, you know, even if I don't feel good right now, there's a good chance that I will feel good during that activity, and that after I'm done, I'm not going to regret it. This works for things that are healthy and that you should be doing. Obviously, like if you're fucking doing cocaine or heroin and you're just like, yeah, I need to take some action and do some cocaine so I feel good about myself. Obviously, you shouldn't use it for harmful activities like that. That wouldn't really apply here. I'd say those are more extra curricular activities if you choose to partake, but for things that you know, like those, everyone knows the shit that you should be doing. The things that when, after you do it, you never regret it. I've never regretted working out. I've never regretted sitting down and writing. I've never regretted having a tough conversation. I've never regretted doing meaningful work and working towards, you know, finding my purpose, whatever that is. Right now, that's podcasting. For someone else, it might be running a financial firm, or, you know, being a stand-up comedian, or being an Uber driver, like whatever the fuck it is, you can know that action can be your first plan of attack. You don't have to wait to feel inspired. Wow, that felt good. So I guess the next thing that was on my mind is I saw the film Peanut Butter Falcon last week. I watched it with my brothers kind of over the Christmas, New Year's break in work. I watched the movie Peanut Butter Falcon. And for those of you who are not familiar with the movie, and don't worry, I will not give away any spoilers. I'm just going to talk about literally one 30-second part of the movie that is not, doesn't really give anything away, but I thought it was super important. And when I finished watching the movie, I actually made a note of it because I knew that this is something I either wanted to talk about or write about. So Peanut Butter Falcon has three main characters: Tyler, who's played by Shia LaBeouf, who is kind of this wandering nomad, fishing town guy who does some bad shit, but he has a good heart. Then there's Zach, who has Down syndrome, and he ends up getting out of he stays at a retirement home because there's nowhere left in the state for him to stay in mental facilities. That's what they say in the movie. So Zach is a young character with Down syndrome. I believe he's in his early 20s, 22 years old, and he meets Shia LaBeouf. And there's also this woman named Eleanor who works for the retirement home that Zach escapes from. And she kind of catches up to Tyler and Zach on their journey. And there's one scene in particular where all three of them are kind of chilling on a raft that was handcrafted by Tyler and Zach. And Eleanor is also on this raft. So it's three of them. It's Shia LaBeouf, Zach, and Eleanor. And Eleanor is kind of babying Zach. Eleanor is saying, you know, you shouldn't put your head underwater. They're kind of like trying to see how long they could hold their breath and train for upcoming future events. That's part of the movie. Like they're trying to get to this wrestling event. Eleanor is saying, you know, it's not safe for you to be on this boat. You should really put a shirt on. She tries to put it on for him. And throughout this whole journey, Tyler has not treated Zach like he needs help. He's basically treated him like a normal person. He doesn't think about, oh, how should I treat someone with Down syndrome? He just says the shit that's on his mind that he would do and say to a normal person. And he just acts like he's just any other dude. And so when he sees Eleanor babying Zach, Tyler, Shia LaBeouf's character, kind of stands up and says, hey, Eleanor, stop calling Zach a retard. And Eleanor says back to him, I would never call him a retard. I would never use that word. And Shia LaBeouf says, you don't have to use the word to call someone a retard. You can do it with how you speak about them. And when I heard that in the movie, I kind of sat back and I was like, wow, that's really true. You can call someone something without actually using the word, just by the way that you act around them, by the way that you speak about them, just by the way you kind of go through life. You can make people feel a certain way by just treating them a certain way. You don't have to say, I think you're a fucking idiot, or I think you're retarded, or I think, you know, you're a fat piece of shit. You can kind of get around that by treating them in a certain way, or maybe alluding to them in a certain way, and not actually say it to their face, not actually call them that. So while I don't think that Eleanor, it meant that, you know, she wasn't calling Zach retarded in any way, she was clearly babying him and doing things that he could take care of on his own. And that can apply to a lot of things. There, even in my life, there have been times where I don't treat people the way that I should have. And it wasn't because I was necessarily calling them a name. It was because I went into that conversation or that encounter with some pre-existing notion, or, you know, not really maybe censoring myself because, you know, maybe I thought that person didn't want to hear it or wasn't capable of understanding that idea, or for some reason the interaction just wasn't as meaningful or as truthful as it could have been. That scene really, really drove home the point that you can make someone feel lesser without actually insulting them. I love the way that Shia LaBeouf treats Tyler throughout this film. You know, he does some Tyler does some fucked up shit. I love the way that Shia LaBeouf treats Zach throughout this film. Zach is the character with Down syndrome. Shia LaBeouf does some fucked up shit. He's not 100% good guy, but then again, no one is. If you claim to be perfect, you're not perfect, but he clearly does have a good heart, and he treats Zach just like he's anyone else. He doesn't say, okay, Zach has Down syndrome, this is how I'm going to treat him. He treats him the same way he would his mom or his best friend, which is, hey, I'm going to make fun of you. You know, I'm going to give it to you straight. And I'm not going to treat you like you are a living, walking, talking label. I'm just going to treat you like you're someone I hang out with, like a best friend. And I think that's the best way, the best way to treat people, the best way to go about shit in life. And I think a lot of time, I think that also has a connection to the identity politics that's going on today. I think there's a lot of discussion, a lot of conversation around how we should treat people of different skin colors, of different sexualities, of different genders, and the idea that people deserve points given to them or points taken away based on their race, their gender, their sexuality. For example, Sam Harris, who, if you've been listening to this podcast, you know, is someone that I admire and someone that I listen to often, and I've read his work. He talks about getting to a post-racial society, which is to mean the color of your skin is the least interesting thing about you. So I'm white. If I see a black person walking down the street, there's no charge in me, or there's nothing in me that says, okay, this person is black, therefore I know this about them also. What Sam Harris is saying is that in a post-racial society, their skin color is not interesting because it means nothing. It's literally just a pigmentation. You know nothing about someone that has black skin or brown skin or white skin other than the fact that that's the color of their skin. You're not extrapolating their personality or their decision making or their politics onto their skin color. If you want to, you can go talk to that person and find out how they treat other people, how they take actions, what their ideologies are. But if you just see someone and you see that they're black, or you see that someone's gay, or someone is a man or a woman, you have no fucking clue how that person thinks. And I think in Peanut Butter Falcon, that's kind of how Tyler approaches the situation with Zach having Down syndrome. He doesn't see him as this Down syndrome character. He sees him as Zach, the human being who happens to have Down syndrome. But that obviously comes with its own limitations in terms of how the Down syndrome disorder affects you biologically. But there are many things that he has, he can choose for himself, and he chooses how to live his life. Just because you have Down syndrome doesn't mean that you're a good person. Just because you have Down syndrome doesn't mean you're an asshole. Down syndrome doesn't mean anything. It means that you have Down syndrome, and Tyler doesn't treat him any differently because of that. So I think that's even more relevant in today's identity politics world, where, you know, if you're a straight white male, people pretend to know all this shit about you and how much easier you've had it, and, you know, things that you think or things that you don't think or how you vote. And then if you're black, you should vote this way or you think this way, kind of like this group think where every white person thinks the same and every black person thinks the same. Every woman thinks the same. Every gay person thinks the same. Every straight person thinks the same. It's like this monolith of thought where people think that one black person can speak for the entire black community. Like, I think that's such a toxic idea. There's no monolith of thought based on your skin color, based on your sexuality, or based on your gender. You think for yourself and you come to your own conclusions. You don't think with your skin. You don't think with your gender. You don't think with your sexuality. You can create ideas apart from that. And anyone who makes you feel like you can't, you should cut those people out of your lives. If someone tells you, you know, a black person can't vote like this, or, you know, a woman can't do this, or if you're a white dude, that means you do this, you should not be around those people. It's a toxic way of thinking, and I don't think that it is something that we should pursue and waste our time with. There's so many fucking cool people in this world. Why the fuck would you care about their skin color or about their race? Like, those are both the same. Their skin color or their sexuality, gender, whatever it is. Like, why the fuck would you waste your time being interested in that? It's not interesting. It doesn't tell you anything about that person, which is why when I interview guests on a podcast, I rarely bring up, you know, what is it like to be, you know, a black music artist, or like, how do you feel being biracial, or like, what does it mean as a gay singer songwriter? Like, I don't give a shit. I don't think that being gay has an effect on how good of a songwriter you are or what you are able to do. The only thing that I know is that you're attracted to the same sex. Other than that, I don't give a fuck, and I don't know anything else about you. So, yeah, shout out to Shia LaBeouf, Zach, and everyone involved in Peter Butter Falcon. I think it's a great movie, and you guys should definitely check it out. I highly recommend it. Let's see what else. 2 months ago I quit porn. That was pretty cool. I know I've talked about that a little bit on the podcast before, but yeah, so I would say probably 6 months back I experimented with quitting porn. I wanted to stop watching porn for 1 month, and the reason was simple. I never considered myself a porn addict. I still don't. It was almost a daily part of my life for about 15 to 20 minutes, and I would watch porn and jerk off before I went to bed, and so did a bunch of my friends. So I just absentmindedly thought, like, this is what guys do. There's no problem with this because everyone else does it. Like, who doesn't watch fucking porn, jerk off, and go to bed? And I had this experience where I was visiting a girl in DC. We had had sex multiple times that night, and then we did it again in the morning. And then I came back to New York that same day, like hours later, and jerked off to porn. Like, I didn't feel sexually satisfied just from the sex. I felt like I needed something else, and that porn was that satisfaction that I needed to watch porn. And it kind of scared me that I was just having sex. I literally was just inside this beautiful woman. And then I come back home and I'm not sexually satisfied. I feel like I still need something, like I'm still craving something. And so I quit porn for a month. I don't think that was long enough to kind of know how my body was going to react, because it was a month. But, you know, I did spend a lot less screen time on my phone. I wasn't constantly surfing through my phone at night, because after I would watch porn, then I would go bang into like the fucking YouTube rabbit hole. And maybe I would stay up for an extra hour because the blue light on my phone is fucking with my eyes and it just keeps me awake. So a lot of the reason why I wanted to quit porn was just because of the utility and going to bed earlier and not staring at my phone right before, because that was kind of my habit. But so 2 months ago, I quit porn completely. I went for about a month before that, then started watching porn again. And then I quit porn completely, about 2 months ago. So the first thing that I noticed was the flatline. And this is actually a term that was coined in the book, Your Brain on Porn. Let me just look that up real quick just to see the author. Your Brain on Porn. By Gary Wilson. That's a dude. So Your Brain on Porn by Gary Wilson. He also has a website. And he talks about this thing called the flatline in the book, where, right, if you quit porn, if you've been a regular user of porn, you go through this stage. It could be a week, it could be months, depending on, you know, how deep into it you were. For me, it lasted about a week, maybe a week and a half, where you just don't get hard, basically. Like you see a hot ass woman walking down the street, or, you know, you see some side boob in an ad or whatever, and you feel aroused mentally, but for a guy, like, your dick just isn't responding. Like, you're just lying there like a fucking flaccid ass sausage that just got its spine ripped out, basically. Like, the point is that you go through this flat line. Like, it's literally a flat line. You don't get aroused. And like, I didn't know that going into it, because I started reading this book after I'd quit. But yeah, there's a period of time where you just don't get aroused like you used to. And he talks about this in the book, and I felt like this a little too. Your brain is so used to that constant stimulation of watching porn, and you're getting it through, you know, combing through thousands of videos. You know, when I'm going on Pornhub, I'm going through thumbnails and fucking thumbnails and fucking thumbnails. And you spend 3 hours trying to find the right video, and then every time after that you need something more intense to get you off. So you have this fucking open, this plethora of porn that you have so many options to get you off. You have so many fucking like fetishes and pages and different categories that you can just go deeper and deeper and deeper every single time, and you're doing that every day. And then you cut that off completely. Your brain is kind of going like, what the fuck? Like, you're not going to give me this shit now? Okay, well, your dick's not going to work. And that's kind of what happened for a week. And I wish I'd known that going into it, because it made me think that watching porn, I should go back to watching porn, because, you know, I wanted my dick to feel like it always did. But after about a week and a half, things went back to normal. And I felt like I was getting, you know, better boners, and, you know, I was feeling aroused more easily. After that kind of flatline period, I definitely felt more sensitive to arousal. I kind of think of it like going back to being a two-beer queer. If you don't drink alcohol that often, you can get fucked up really easily off of a couple of beers. Same thing with porn. If you're not constantly watching porn, you get aroused really easily by things that you see. Even like I would have never gotten super aroused when I was watching porn by just seeing a lingerie ad. Now if I see that walking around the city, like, bang. Like I get aroused much more easily, get boners much more easily. Just to clarify, I still jerk off. I just don't use porn. So when I feel the need to jerk off, I use my imagination, which is how I first started. So, I mean, I guess that's a plus. You're using your creativity to jerk off. You're imagining the highlight reel or different situations in your mind to jerk off, which also allows me to still cut down on screen time. I'm not staying awake, and I'm not like responding to the need to watch porn. Like a lot of times I wouldn't even feel like jerking off, but I would watch porn anyway, and then I would jerk off because I was watching porn. Now, if I don't feel like jerking off, I go to bed. If I feel like jerking off, I fucking jerk off. It's not tied to porn. Another thing that I noticed is that I feel more motivated to go out and meet new women, because I know that if I want to have sex, if I want to see the things that I'm going to see during sex, you know, if I want to see a woman get naked, for example, I'm not seeing that on porn anymore. So it's like, all right, if I'm ever going to fucking see that, then I need to go out in person and put myself out there and meet new people, go on dates, have a healthy sex life. I think I'm pretty fortunate because I did have a decent sex life while I was watching porn. Like, I was never one of those guys who would rather stay in and jerk off and watch porn than go out and meet a beautiful woman. But I know there are guys out there that are like that. And Gary Wilson talks about that in the book. There's even there's a Reddit community called NoFap, where guys that have it even worse than me. I consider myself lucky with porn, because I never got to the point where I was watching it, you know, for hours a day and my life was being affected by it. But there are a lot of guys that, you know, they can't even get hard for real sex because they're watching so much fucking porn and they have anxiety, depression, and that kind of just like snap fades away when they start watching porn, or when they stop watching porn, excuse me. And there's a line in the book that I wanted to talk about. It's about desensitization. And so Gary Wilson writes, quote, "Reduced dopamine and opioid signaling leave the addict less sensitive to everyday pleasures and more hungry for dopamine raising activities and substances." Basically, when you are watching porn constantly, you get that constant barrage of sexual imagery. You're reducing your brain's sensitivity to the dopamine hit. So you need more and more of that hit, which is why people watch more and more fucked up porn, just to get that like dopamine rush of I'm doing something fun right now. Like, you need to watch more fucking wild ass porn, more fetishes, like more, it's like things that you wouldn't have even thought you would watch when you first started watching porn, just to get that same hit of dopamine. And so when you quit that, it will take a while for your brain to resettle, which is kind of like that flatline period. But then it does go back to a happy medium where you get aroused again by normal sexual activity. Again, like, I was never at the point where I was choosing porn over sex, but for a lot of guys that is the case, and that continues to be the case. So there's a lot of good information in this book. I also, you know, I'm not one of those guys that's in the hardcore no porn group. I think that there is a way that porn can be consumed in a less risky way. Not everyone that likes porn that watches porn is addicted to it. I don't think I was addicted to it. It was just more of a habit that I wanted to remove from my life. It started out as basically an experiment of, you know, I'm going to quit porn for a month and see what happens. Okay, I like that. Now I'm going to quit it ongoing. And it's been really good. I definitely feel, you know, more ready to go during sexual experiences. I feel, you know, more easily aroused. There's also a popular sentiment out there that says that, you know, like, if you're a guy, you need to jerk off before you have sex with your girlfriend or before you have sex with whoever. Before, so you're less sensitive and so you are performing well, so you last longer. I've actually found that I last longer now without porn, which is weird because I'd been in the same thought process where, you know, if I knew I was gonna have sex that night, I would jerk off during the day so I lasted longer at night. And I was afraid when I quit porn, I wouldn't be jerking off as much, and then my sexual experiences would be impacted by that. Like, you know, maybe porn was good because I was, you know, getting that fix and kind of like training my dick in some way. I don't know. But yeah, I've found that I've lasted longer, and that, you know, it hasn't had a decrease in any way on sexual performance. If anything, there's been, I've stayed the same or have increased, which has been great, because that's what I was worried about. But yeah, I think that porn can be consumed in a less risky way. I don't think everyone that watches porn is addicted to it. Like, not everyone has a problem with porn. If you want to watch porn, go the fuck ahead. I'm just trying to tell you my experience. If you're thinking about quitting porn, or if you want to just experiment with it, don't watch it for a month. Don't watch it for 2 weeks. See what happens, see how you feel, and then make your own conclusions. And if you're interested in it, check out the book Your Brain on Porn by Gary Wilson. Let me take a sip of Nespresso. Nespresso should sponsor us, by the way. Probably drink like 5 Nespresso decafs a day, because I try to not drink as much caffeine anymore. Okay. Let's see here. I think the last thing that I'd like to talk about is the J.K. Rowling incident. So J.K. Rowling, the author of Harry Potter, recently tweeted in support of a woman named Maya Forstadter, and she worked at the Center for Global Development. Maya Forstadter worked at the Center for Global Development, which is a think tank that works to reduce global The Center for Global Development is a think tank that works to reduce global poverty and inequality. And Maya Forstadter tweeted this in September of 2018, which led to her firing a year later. She tweeted, quote, Maya Forstadter tweeted, quote, "What I am so surprised at is that smart people I admire, who are absolutely pro-science in other areas and champion human rights and women's rights, are tying themselves in knots to avoid saying the truth that men cannot change into women, because that might hurt men's feelings." Maya Forstadter tweeted that in September 2018. That tweet was dug up almost a year later, and she was fired by it. J.K. Rowling later came out in support of Maya Forstadter in the form of a tweet, and then the hashtag J.K. Rowling party, or J.K. Rowling is over party, J.K. Rowling is canceled. Basically, people got up into a shitstorm, and keep in mind, this is not the average person. I don't think the average person even knows that this was going on between J.K. Rowling and the liberals and the left. I think the average person doesn't even know about this incident. When I say people, it's all the people on Twitter. So in response to Maya getting fired for her tweet saying men cannot change into women, J.K. Rowling tweeted, "Dress however you please, call yourself whatever you like, sleep with any consenting adult who will have you, live your best life in peace and security, but force women out of their jobs for stating that sex is real? Hashtag I stand with Maya. Hashtag this is not a drill." J.K. Rowling then proceeded to get canceled on Twitter, which, if you've been following cancellations on Twitter, you know that it's not really being canceled. It's more like people throw a tantrum on Twitter. You know, some people may unsubscribe to you or unfollow you, but then 24 hours later, no one gives a shit because someone new or some new organization is getting canceled every single day on Twitter. But I think this kind of shows the weakness and how the social justice warriors operate, because for them, you can never be woke enough. For the people that wake up on Twitter and tweet about how woke they are and how much they care about social justice and all that kind of virtue signaling bullshit, you can never be woke enough, because J.K. Rowling was someone who was part of that woke piece of society. She was coming out in support of gay rights, and even saying that certain people in the Harry Potter series were actually gay, like coming out and saying like, oh, Dumbledore is gay, Ron is gay, whatever. I didn't really follow that. But the point is that J.K. Rowling coming into this situation was woke. She was considered woke. She was a social justice warrior. She said all the right things. And because of this one tweet where she defended Maya saying you should be allowed to say men can change into women, she was then effectively canceled, which goes to prove the point that you can never be woke enough. She was canceled by the very people that she supported. And so, yeah, basically, you can never be woke enough. However woke you think you are, the social justice warriors will come for you, and they came for J.K. Rowling. Again, I equate the cancel culture more of like a tantrum on Twitter. As long as you're allowed to keep your Twitter account and keep your YouTube and you aren't completely thrown off, there are people that are demonetized. There are people that get kicked off the platform completely. But I think and that sucks. There are some situations, yeah, where I believe that you should be kicked off of Twitter and you should be demonetized. But for the majority of people that aren't violating free speech, that is not the case. You should be allowed to say what you want, even if other people disagree with it. And yeah, just to advocate for the part where men can't change into women, biologically, a man can't turn into a woman and vice versa. You can change your genitals, you can get hormones, you can have all the surgery, but biologically, you will still be XX or XY, depending on if you are female or male. Your biological makeup will not change. The way your body works will not completely change. You will still be a male and you will still be a female if you were born that way. And this is not to say that I am insensitive to the plight of transgender people. I don't know what it's like to be confused by your gender. I can only imagine how fucking shitty and hurtful and just dark that time period must be in your life, how helpless you must feel to want to just live a normal life and just, you know, be like everyone else and be secure with your gender and not be able to have that. I completely feel for people who are going through transitions, because that is a toughness and that is a darkness that I will never have to deal with. But what I do think is harmful to men, to women, and to transgender people is trying to erase gender. There are differences in gender between men and women. There are biological differences. And there's a great book called Why Gender Matters by Dr. Leonard Sachs. He has studied, little phlegm ball there for a sec. Yeah, Dr. Leonard Sachs has studied gender differences in the classroom for 3 decades. And there are differences in how women smell, how they perceive motion, how men and women smell and perceive motion, how men and women socialize, how men and women experience sex. There are all these distinct differences that are not better or worse. They're just different. And these differences should be celebrated. And I think right now we're going through a time where the gender differences are trying to be erased. People with an agenda are trying to say there is no difference between men and women. And this is not only false, but it is unsafe. You will harm men and women by trying to pretend that you can treat them both the same, that they're, sorry, not treat them both the same, but to kind of erase all the differences between them. Of course, you should treat someone with respect regardless of their gender, but there are distinct differences that can affect how you're treated. And for example, in a medical situation, for example, if you are trying to treat a woman or a man, there are differences in how people handle certain medicines or prescriptions or certain surgeries, the statistics that really matter, that if you try to erase things like that, it would not be helpful. And I understand why people would want these differences to be erased, because for thousands of years, women being different than men meant that women were second class citizens. It meant that women were treated like shit because they were different than men. And so I think as a reaction to that, we now have biological proof that yes, there are differences between men and women, but I think people are scared that these differences will lead to women again being second class citizens, which I do not think is the case. I think these differences should be celebrated. I think these differences do not mean men are better or women are better or men are worse or women are worse. I think these are just differences. It will help people interact and will help us understand each other if everyone is aware of these differences and we don't pretend like they don't exist. I think that's harmful for everyone, no matter what community you're in, man, women, transgender person. We will all benefit by learning more about these differences, by studying them, by being aware of them. If you want to check out some of these differences, again, there's a great book called Why Gender Matters by Dr. Leonard Sachs, where he gets in kind of these social differences, learning differences, like I was talking about before, differences in smell, motion, things like that. So definitely check that out. The last thing I wanted to end on, another sip of Nespresso decaf. Wow, my throat is actually kind of like dry from this. Usually when I record a podcast, I'm not talking the whole time. I'm letting someone else speak. Obviously, like with when I have guests on, but talking for 45 minutes straight really takes a toll on your vocal cords. So I will take that into account next time. Maybe drink some more tea. The quote I wanted to end on is, the future belongs to those who can learn skills and combine them in creative ways. Then that was said by Robert Greene. Again, the future belongs to those who can learn skills and combine them in creative ways. I think that's never been more apparent in today's society. We don't have the same structure that, you know, my parents grew up in. My parents are 60 years old. They started working for the same company. They actually started their business, but they've been working for the same business for 30 years. A lot of other people in that generation, you know, they get a job and they keep that same job for 25, 30 years, 40 years, and then they retire, they get a pension, and that was the cycle. Now we are living in a time where people are changing jobs more frequently than they ever had. You can't rely on the pension system. You have to save for yourself. You have to create jobs when they don't exist. And I think podcasting is a good example of that. Podcasting is something that I had never thought could be my career. I didn't discover podcasting until I was 23, 24 years old. It was never even a part of my life. I didn't listen to podcasts. I didn't record podcasts. And since then, podcasting has allowed me to tap into other skills and use those in creative ways to not only add to the repertoire, but to kind of feed off of each other. So, you know, reading is something that I do now because I think it's my responsibility as a podcaster to be informed on different topics and ideas and things going on in the world. So, I mean, I read before in school things that I was required to do, but I never really sought out books and read them just for the fun of it. And now it's one of the most fun things I do. Writing. I'd never written before. I never wrote for just out of leisure, just things I wanted to write about. It was always for an assignment. Kind of sucked the soul out of me, like those 10-page term papers in high school and college. I'd never written about something that I genuinely just, you know, thought about and wanted to expand on. So it's helped me expand on my own thoughts. Got into videography a little bit, creating video content, learning how to reach out to guests and craft emails and make business decisions and monetize. All these things are skills that I have learned within the past 3 or 4 years and are trying to combine them in creative ways. And I think that now is a great time to sort of unspecialize yourself. Podcasting will always be a mainstay in what I do. I love podcasting, but at the same time, I want to be adequate in other things too. It doesn't mean you need to be an expert in 5 or 6 different things, but you can be an expert in 1, maybe 2 things, but then be competent in other skills and use those, learn them as much as you have to, as much as it's useful to you. And then for anything more, you can always outsource to other people that are experts in their field too, which is sometimes what I do with editing for the podcast. If I don't have enough time to do something, I will outsource my editing to someone else and they will edit it for me, and they are a lot better at doing it. They can do it quicker. They can do something I can do in 4 hours and 1 hour. And so take that into account too. You can always outsource. But yes, I wanted to end on this. The future belongs to those who can learn skills and combine them in creative ways. And that was said by Robert Greene. That is the end of Auxoro Chat number one. And I hope you enjoyed that. I will see you guys for Auxoro Chat number two next week. See you guys next time.